Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast 110. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around, I'm doing Fantastica, Russian science fiction from the year 2017. We're starting out with the movie where a spaceship crashes into a housing complex just south of Moscow, and that is Attraction. And then we move on to one of the movies that I've been looking forward to seeing, which is the 2017 Russian superhero movie Guardians, which is very, very cool. So sit back, I will get the contact details out of the way, and we'll get this puppy started. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest as genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Okay, how is everybody going? Unfortunately, this one's a little bit late, and I apologize for that. I just kind of got a bit tired, which is one of the reasons why I joined a gym. I've just joined a gym. I've been twice. I've done some treadmill workout. I'm trying to build my cardio up before I get into the weights. We'll see how we go with that. I paid for a year in advance, so I probably should use it. Nonetheless, I'm kind of looking at getting my fitness to where I'd like it to be, and it isn't there now. So winter is here in Melbourne. The day is cloudy and a bit cold. I mean, not cold, Canadian cold, not North American cold, but cold by our standards. Very cold by standards in the Northern Territory, where if it gets below 20 degrees centigrade, they start putting on jumpers. But yeah, so it's that time of year again. Let's see. So what have I been watching? It's a few things. Some good, some not so good. I did see The Fate of the Furious, the latest in the Fast and the Furious franchise, which is a really odd franchise because every character, all the men are bald, for a start. It was just kind of unusual for this kind of franchise. You've got The Rock, you've got Statham, you've got Vin Diesel, of course, so there's not a lot of hair happening there. Which makes it a slightly unusual franchise at the start. But yeah, it's got this kind of theme of family, but outlaw family. It's got outrageous car stunts and special effects and some slightly science fictional computery gear chucked in there, along with a whole bunch of good character actors like Kurt Russell. But in a sense, it's also kind of empty. It's not my favourite franchise at all. I don't think it's nuanced, and I don't think it's particularly intelligent, but it's all action and no filler. So I watched that. I did watch the American remake of Ghost in the Shell, which wasn't very good, I'll be honest with you. It really tried to copy the anime one, of which I've spoken on a previous Martian Driving podcast. And it just doesn't work. It really doesn't. I wouldn't bother. It's really not worth your time or your effort. Along with the remake of The Magnificent Seven, I was in a remake mode for some reason. And I watched both of those remakes, and neither of them is at all necessary. They should never have been done. The remake of Magnificent Seven by Antoine Fuqua really didn't need to get made. It was purely one of those things where somebody had the rights and thought they could make some money out of it, and they probably did. But as far as from a cinematic heritage kind of point of view, nah, It really doesn't work. And speaking of movies that don't work, I also saw one of my vulgar pleasures, a 1966-67 movie, which was incredibly bad, directed by Russell Rouse. It's The Oscar, starring Stephen Boyd, Tony Bennett, Jill Ireland, Britt Eklund, and a whole bunch of cameos from famous actors of the time. And it's really bad. Harlan Ellison wrote the script, and apparently each page of the script was rewritten by a secretary. It's really one of those movies that's got to be seen to be believed. The only version I could find was a video transcription from a VHS pan and scan version, but this movie has got to be seen to be believed. It's not quite Tommy Wiseau bad, but it is very, very bad. And if you haven't seen The Oscar, maybe you should if you're a connoisseur of totally shit cinema. I got the soundtrack album to it, by the way. I picked that up when I was in the US many moons ago. May even be worth something now, but who knows. And I also saw the Resident Evil, the final chapter with Mila Jovovich. And again, it's lots of people jumping around and killing monsters and tons of explosions and enormous amounts of zombies, tanks, missiles, rocket launches, all the rest of it, but really not a lot else beside that. If you're a fan of the franchise, obviously you're going to go see it and get off on the kinetic action of it, but you're not going to be finding anything subtle in this kind of a movie. And, you know, if that's your kind of thing, go for it. I think I've seen all of the Resident Evil movies. And after the first one, they kind of blew together a bit. Of course, it's based on a computer game, so there are limitations based on that. Though I want to have a little bit of a talk a little bit later about how computer games and cinema are emerging. But if you're a fan of Resident Evil, Resident Evil, the final chapter is definitely going to be something that ticks the box for you. I did see two Marx Brothers movies because I heard about Marx Brothers. They were talking about it a little bit on Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal podcast, and I thought I'd go and dip into it. So I got my new toy out. My new toy is a Cody box. Now, Cody box needs some explanation. It's an Android box, which is a media server, essentially. You can hook your hard drive into it and play media from it. But it also goes online and finds movies for you. Now, the legality of the extra add-ons on a Kodi box is moot. You can argue that they're out there so you can see them. You don't pay for them. And even though the Kodi box can hook up to your Netflix account, I don't know if it does Stan, but I definitely know it does Netflix. It also does YouTube, amongst other things. It's a little box about the size of a cigar box, maybe a little bit smaller. And runs an Android operating system. And I did a search, and I found Marx Brothers movies on this, so I watched them. I saw Duck Soup and Monkey Business, and they were both a lot of fun. Monkey Business in particular, because the script was written by one of my favourite comedy writers of the time, S.J. Perelman. I've got the best of S.J. Perelman in a fat paperback here. And the essays and the comic bits that Perelman wrote are hilarious. The wordplay, the concepts, just the sheer insanity of S.J. Perelman's work is something you should really check out. And Monkey Business is good. Duck Soup is good as well. Later Marx Brothers movies, less so, of course. But just watching the inventiveness of these four brothers was a tonic. It was a lot of fun to do. So I watched that. And the other thing I watched was something that harked back to my cultural roots as a cinephile. And that was Death Race 2050, the Roger Corman produced remake of Death Race 2000, the original Paul Bartel one, not the one with Jason Statham and a whole bunch of cars where they actually took the concept seriously. This one's got Malcolm McDowell in it and a bunch of other people who you know some faces, but you don't really know who they are. It goes back to the original source in the fact that it's low-budget exploitation, political satire. The chairman, who's like the president of the United States, played by Malcolm McDowell, has a really bad hairstyle a la Trump. There are lots and lots of car crashes and insane little bits of business. There's one of the cars is an AI who has a character arc throughout the movie. And yeah, it was actually a lot of fun. If you sit back and watch it through the lens of 1970s exploitation rather than 2010 exploitation, it really does work. And it's a lot of fun. And I enjoyed it. I picked it up on Blu-ray very cheaply. They had a 2-for-1 Blu-ray deal down at JB Hi-Fi. So that was one of the Blu-rays I picked up. And to be honest with you, I think I got my money's worth with it. It's, yeah, it's a bit of fun, but you've really got to kind of look at it from that exploitation point of view. Put aside the Death Race remakes of a few years ago and go back to the original and just enjoy it for what it is, which is cheap exploitation. Lots of seams showing. Production values aren't fantastically good, but it's silly fun. And sometimes you just need that. And sometimes you need to go back to that kind of old-fashioned exploitation wonderfulness. And Death Race 2050 really does that quite well. The other news is I'm recording the next Martian Driver podcast live at Continuum 13, the local science fiction convention I go to every year. It also happens to be the National Science Fiction Convention this year. And I've got 1-hour slot rather than a 2-hour slot, so I'm just going to be Fast and Furious without Vin Diesel. A 1-hour podcast, I'd probably cram it into 55 minutes, but I'm going to try to see what else I can pick up as far as audio and talking to people around the convention. And going with that, I'm going to have a couple of guests along. Paul Poulton's back. I've had him on the podcast before. And I'm going to rope in one or two other people just to kind of freewheel the podcast, just talk about genre and what's upcoming in genre, what you think is good in genre, what you think is bad in genre. And so I'm looking forward to that too. It's kind of nice to do it in front of a live audience. A little bit different to sitting here staring at a screen alone in the man cave. But you know, now and then you've got to cleanse your palate. And I think that that's going to be what Martian Driving Podcast 211 is going to be. I may even do a little bit myself before that, if I can find a movie to review. So I'll make it the normal length. I'll give it a bit of, you know, a little bit of legs by adding something else, but I'll also include the live recording in there as well. So possibilities are endless, and there's no rules apart from keeping you guys listening. Now it's time to take a break, and when I get back I'm going to be talking about Attraction, a 2017 Russian science fiction movie about an alien spaceship crashing on the outskirts of Moscow and how things play out after it does.
Сегодня на юге столицы можно наблюдать редкое космическое явление.
С запада вошел объект. Движется в нашу сторону.
Все управляемый.
Поднимайте перехватчики.
Полная готовность применения.
Так красиво!
Take me to the place where there's no gravity.
Совсем близко видела.
Russian Fantastica has a long history. It's got as long a history as anybody else's science fiction. They were making science fiction movies in the silent era, for instance, with Alita, which was set on Mars. In 1935, you got Cosmic Voyage, which was basically a movie about an attempt to go to the moon. And The effects on it are fantastic. They're way ahead of anything that England or America was doing at the time and was doing up until the 1960s. It really that far advanced and that far ahead of the curve. But because of the language difficulties and, of course, the political difficulties, these movies weren't seen until relatively recently, but they are terrifically good. They had a series of movies between 1947 and 1970 called Road to the Stars, which has, again, almost a documentary look about them. It's a science fiction directed by a guy called Pavel Klushnadev-Sev, and he was kind of combining documentary with live-action science fiction. And, of course, Roger Corman in the 1960s, to get back to Roger Corman for a moment, released and recut a number of Russian fantastic movies for movies like Voyage to the Prehistoric Planet and Queen of Blood by salvaging and cannibalizing the best bits out of some Russian science fiction movies, throwing in alternate plot lines and American casts and making a go of it like that. Then, of course, you've got Tarkovsky's Solaris and any number of films since then. So, yeah, Russia's got a good history making science fiction movies. And in 2017, a couple have come out, which are kind of interesting. I don't think they're perfect films. I think that they've each got their flaws, but I think they're really interesting. And at least one of them is going to start a franchise, being, of course, Guardians, which a sequel has been greenlit for it, even though the movie itself wasn't a real big box office hit. I think that the characters engaged people, and there's a lot of social media buzz about the movie, which is cool. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about is the fact that I came from a literary science fiction background to a certain extent, and that always had an international flavor to it. Of course, then, being an Australian, a lot of the science fiction I read was either English or American, but there were also translations of other science fiction works by people like Stanislaw Lem and the Strugatsky brothers, amongst others. And so it wasn't too big a leap for me to kind of like and really kind of groove on Russian science fiction movies. They just look different, but they look good different. The technologies used, it's a bit like if you have a look at really early technology, say Russian computers versus American computers, back when computers were enormous. There were different kind of design aesthetics about them, and that carried over into science fiction movies. The technologies and the industrialization of America versus Russia were very different, and the approaches they took to industrial design were very different, and that flowed over into science fiction movies. And even in these two movies, there's a bit of that too, even though there is some kind of convergence, particularly with Guardians and the Guardian headquarters, where the technologies do look a little bit American with those kind of see-through flat screens and computer graphics. There's still that Russian kind of design aesthetic coming in there, and I kind of like that as well. But and to get back to Attraction. Attraction, the title, by the way, is a kind of, you know, there are two ways you can translate it. One of which, of course, is gravity. So the title could be translated as gravity. Or else attraction between two objects or two people. So there's a nice kind of duality to that title. It's an interesting film, and it actually has a social context as well. The director of the movie, Fyodor Bondarchuk, said that it was partly inspired by a real-life riot in the southern suburbs of Moscow in 2013, which was known as the Biryulyovo riots. There was an announcement that a 25-year-old man was killed by a migrant who might have come from Central Asia or the Caucasus. And in October 2013, footage of the man being stabbed was circulated by the news agencies. The previous day, some 40 people gathered to demand justice. The police announced a reward of 1 million rubles for any information for the suspect. The riots turned violent as the protesters, a mixed crowd of nationalists and locals, attacked properties owned by migrants. On the 14th of October, the police arrested more than 1,200 migrant workers when the killer allegedly lived. In October 15th of October, An Azerbaijani citizen was arrested as a suspect for the killing of the man, whose name was Igor Shcherbakov, just outside of Moscow. So basically, it was a little bit of a Rodney King kind of thing. But also, it was based on that fear and hatred of immigrants. And so Bondarchuk, when he was making Attraction, decided that he was going to make that one of the themes of this science fiction movie that he made. And it works really kind of well for that. And it gives that social context grounding for the science fiction, which is an important aspect to science fiction as a genre, if it's going to have any meaning. The other part of it is a fairy tale, a love story, in fact, between an alien and a Russian girl. Now, that kind of thing, it goes back into various parts of Russian mythology and stuff like that, so it's kind of culturally appropriate in a sense. So basically, get back to the story. I'm going to kind of paraphrase from Wikipedia here. Storyline revolves around Colonel Valentin Lebedev, who's in charge of a military operation. His daughter, Yulia, who develops a romantic relationship with an alien, Hikon, and also it involves her former boyfriend, Artyom, who is the main antagonist. Hikon is a representative of technologically advanced humanoid race who arrive on Earth incognito for research purposes. Their spaceships orbit around the Earth and they just keep tabs on him. He's been there for a very long time. His spaceship gets damaged by a meteor shower, which everybody's out in Moscow to watch because, again, parallels with that big meteorite incident over Russia recently. So there are little bits of echoes with that recent history. The Russian Air Force mistake the spaceship for a large meteor and decide to blast it before it does any damage. It turns out, of course, it's not a meteor, but it's a spaceship. Spaceship's a beautiful thing. You can see it in the trailer if you look at the trailer for this film. It's like a big metal eye with a whole bunch of hoops revolving around it. It's a very nice design. It's very, very different than you get in an American movie. So the spaceship crashes on the outskirts of Moscow. And that the crash itself, which little bits of it are in the trailer, is spectacular. This enormous metal eye with the revolving hoops laterally smashing the tops off apartment blocks and then crashing through a sports stadium and coming to rest in a park is a beautiful piece of special effects work, and it's very evocative and scary as well. And one of the bits that gives us an emotional resonance with that is the fact that Yulia's best friend is on the roof of one of the buildings that gets smashed, and Yulia herself is who's in one of the apartments snogging with Artyom. Almost dies as the building starts to collapse. Now, the cast is pretty good. Irina Stashinbaum plays Yulia. She's really an engaging actress. You know, young, probably in her early 20s, but playing slightly younger than that. You've got Alexander Petrov playing Artyom. And as a villain, he is a thug. I mean, he plays the Russian thug very, very well. You've got Oleg Menshikov playing the colonel, who is Yulia's father, and a few other kind of thugs. There's even a character called Google, who's the resident nerd, played by Evgeny Mikiev, and he's quite fun as well. And then, of course, you've got the main love interest, Hikon, played by an actor called Rino Mokbamvatov. And I'm getting these names wrong, I'm sure I am, but bear with me on it. So what happens is that the spaceship crashes and a cordon sanitaire is spread around the edge of the area. Social media and the media get word of it, and the spaceship and everything around it becomes an intense focus of everybody's attention. There's a curfew in Moscow, and the people who are living in the apartment blocks around the edge of that cordon around the spaceship itself are mostly kind of socioeconomically lower class people, and there are gangs involved with cars and various criminal activities. So, you know, it's one of those places where if you're going to crash an alien spaceship, it's probably one of the worst places as far as social cohesion is concerned you can possibly land it. And we get little bits and pieces of that kind of social stuff. I don't know how accurate it is to the actual lives of people on the outskirts of Moscow. I'm not really familiar with that, but it does play as authentic. Yeah, these guys are rough as guts. They're into machines of various kinds. And we get the idea that Yulia, having Artyom as a boyfriend, she's kind of, you know, punching below her weight. She's kind of got the nasty bad boy boyfriend. And even though at the start of the film, there seems to be a genuine rapport and relationship between them, as things start to get a little tense, and as Yulia meets Hekon, the kind of jealousy and the anger and the sense of the guy owning the girl comes out in Artyom, and he ends up being the antagonist to the piece. There's so many different aspects to this movie that to uncover. There's that kind of romantic thing. There's a touch of Twilight about it because Hekon is an ancient human being. He's been orbiting the Earth for centuries. Even though he does look young, he isn't. And then so you've got that kind of age discrepancy, the same way there is in the Twilight series. But it's not played up and it's not played too very much. In a sense, Hekon is so much of an innocent and in a lot of ways helpless in Moscow that Yulia takes on the mentoring role in a lot of ways, which kind of addresses that imbalance in an interesting way. One of the other things, too, is Hekon has a suit of armor that he wears, which kind of looks a bit Ben 10. It's a kind of curvy, organic-looking armor. No rough edges, but it's a slightly Gumby-looking thing, kind of cross between Gumby and a Ben 10 monster from the Ben 10 TV series, for those of you who aren't familiar with it. And the armor does kind of insert needles into the person who wears it, and there's a scene where after Hekon is out of the armor, Artyom and his gang grab the armor and steal it, and one of the gang was almost absorbed into the armor, and they find out that it does kind of penetrate into your body and become a part of your body when it's worn. And the special effects for that part are really good. As I said, the design aesthetic is not like a design aesthetic particularly for an American science fiction movie. One of the other things that I find really interesting in this is the fact that the Russian government is told by Hekon in his armor at the start of the film that they should leave him to repair the spaceship, and when he repairs the spaceship, he will leave. And they respect that. They don't know what they're dealing with. They're not stupid enough to go on the attack or to invade or to try to take it apart. So they just put a cordon around the spaceship while it's healing. And that kind of shows a wisdom that you don't normally see from governments, Russian, American, Australian, or any other kind. The fact that they're dealing with something very powerful and very unknown. And the best thing that they should do is watch. Now, one of the problems they've got is that a lot of water from the area is being absorbed by this spaceship as part of its repair process. And the local rivers dry up and the water restrictions start happening because there are immense amounts of water that the ship absorbs because it's almost an organic ship. It's even got a name. There's an AI on it called Saul, which is leading the repairs and which acts kind of like a Klaatu type character, that if anything happens to Hekon, then Saul is going to get medieval on Moscow. And so they've got that kind of threat there as a default setting for the spaceship, because of course you don't want rowdy human beings who the alien civilization have decided just aren't ready for contact. You've got that threat of Saul destroying things, plus you've got the other threat which comes as Artyom, who beats up on Hekon when he's in his human form without the armor. Artyom wears the armor and gets into the armor just as Hegon is heading back to his spaceship. The spaceship's been repaired. He's about to leave. And one of the problems is because Artyom and his men are attacking the spaceship, Saul sends out a whole bunch of the armor as drones. And so you've got Artyom wearing one set of the super-powered armor. You've got Hekon and Yulia in an armored car trying to get back to the spaceship while Artyom's attacking them. And you've got Saul defending the spaceship with a whole bunch of other armors. And in the meantime, the military is standing around trying to work out who to shoot and who not to shoot. So there's a lot of kind of tension there. You've got the romance story at the heart of it, which is a bit silly and is a little bit cliched. But you've also got the fact that Artyom and his gang are attacking what essentially is a refugee or an immigrant, in parallel with those 2013 Belyuyovo riots in Moscow. So you've got that kind of locals versus the alien, in a sense, in a number of senses. You've got the military backing off there. You've got Hekon from an essentially utopian society which isn't scared to defend itself. And you've got the romance between Hekon and Yulia at the core of it. And the romance plays out nicely too. It's not overdone. It's kind of gentle, and the characters are well drawn enough that you can kind of buy the romance quite well. And that does kind of, in a sense, it's off to one side of the main plot, because the main plot is this enormous fucking spaceship landing in Moscow, crashing through things, killing a number of people by accident. And there's some kind of ambiguity about it being shot down by the Russian jet fighters as well, as to whether they did think it was a part of the meteor storm, when it's pretty clear when you see the jet fighters and the spaceship itself that they're actually shooting at a spaceship. So there could be a touch of that kind of paranoia, xenophobia, oh look, an alien spaceship is crashing towards Earth, let's blow it out of the sky kind of approach. That's never really addressed, because I think particularly for a Russian-made science fiction movie, you don't want to be seen to make the military and the government look too bad, because suddenly you're drinking a polonium cocktail if you get too antsy. So they kind of stayed away from that. And there's another dynamic too between Lebedev and his daughter Yulia, and the fact that his work has kept him away from her, and their relationship has become strained because of that. And that actually plays to me a lot more interesting than some of the other aspects of the movie as well, because Oleg Menshikov, playing the colonel, is really good, and Irina Starshenbaum, playing Yulia, they do have a rapport, they feel like a family. And that kind of works really well. On the other hand, you've also got Yulia's grandmother, played by a very famous actress in Russia called Lyudmila Maxikova, who's a really cool lady. She's really supportive of Yulia. She's the kind of grandmother you really want to have. She's cool. She's got a very nice apartment. She doesn't take shit from anybody, and she's one of those characters that just pops out of the screen and seems to unlock a lot of characters in a lot of fiction movies, has a sense that there's a story there that we don't know, and that she's got a long history, and she's a very interesting person in her own right. And Maxikova plays that really nicely. I wanted to see more of the grandmother, Lubya, because she's a lot of fun and a very cool lady. So just to kind of wind it up for Attraction, which I think is the lesser of the two movies. I enjoyed Guardians a lot more, but I like this one for a number of things. I like the science fiction aspects. I like the special effects. I like the design for the alien technologies, which are very different than a lot of other things we've seen in a lot of other movies. I think the romance aspect of it plays to, I mean, you got to remember this is a commercial film and it's got to play to a certain audience. And it would play well to young girls, whereas the violence and the thuggish aspect and the street gang aspect may play well to guys as well. The movie was very successful in Russia and got a lot of positive reviews, particularly for the social aspect of it, where you do have a riot that's caused by fear of outsiders. And so those social resonances, which I only picked up a little bit of, would have played a lot stronger to what people knew of their recent history if they were members of a Russian audience. So that's one of the things you've got to consider with these movies is there's a lot of social context that if you don't dive deeply into it when you're watching the movie, you're really going to miss that stuff. And that's okay that you, if you do. If you enjoy the movie at a superficial level and the social context goes past you, fair enough. But I think that it's important to try to at least at some level understand that, because it does mean that you're not missing important aspects of the film and that you're not misjudging the film because of your own cultural preconceptions and the limitations of your knowledge about the culture that developed and created the film. So there is that as well. But I like the film for a lot of reasons. I think it's it'd be nice if it got a DVD and Blu-ray release here in Australia. I think it'd play really well. And it grossed 44 million rubles on the opening day, which was a pretty good result. It's one of those movies which, as pure science fiction, could be seen as a bit of a cliche, but rolling it into recent social events in Russia and making it a part of that means that these people know what they're doing. And like good science fiction, a lot of it is about a reflection of current events rather than an anticipation of the future or a what if. Good strong science fiction always has that resonance with current events in it, and Attraction definitely does that. It's worth checking out. You really should try to see it. But anyway, I'm going to take another break. Now, when we get back, we're going to go to a much more familiar genre with the 2017 Russian film Guardians, a superhero movie, which is, for me, a hell of a lot of fun.
Game is on, cards are dealt, my darling.
I have 2 weeks to search all of the former Soviet Union for the superhumans that can stop a supervillain.
Exactly right. These people are our only hope.
What's the name of the mission?
Guardians.
War is over, we well, and cold and silent.
We're all the same. Lair. Kaz. Arsis. You want to know who did this to you? Come with us.
Rapid military attacks on Moscow continue.
Army turned out to be useless against the opposition forces. All attempts to stop it ended up with a complete shutdown of any machinery.
Our experimental laboratory designed special gear to increase your performance.
Where's mine?
Game is on, cards are dealt, my darling dream.
Guardians is a 2017 Russian superhero science fiction film, which in itself makes it at least worth giving it a go, surely. The story is basically during the Cold War, a secret organization called Patriot, a Russian organization, gathered a team of people whom they turned into superheroes. They altered and augmented their DNA, and there are a lot of them out there. Now, there are five in this movie, one of whom's the villain. But there are actually more of them out there, and we get little hints of that in the post-credit sequences of the movie. So this is a movie that's set up right from the word go for a series. Not a bad thing at all. For me, you can never get too many superhero series, as long as they're not all dark and dismal and horrible and all with cloudy, stormy weather. Not mentioning any particular franchise when I say that. The heroes in this case are kind of meant to represent different qualities of the Russian people and different areas of Greater Russia, of course. The movie stars Sebastian Sisak as Lair, who's an Armenian. He has the ability to manipulate earth and rock and stone, and can even turn chunks of rock into a form of armor for himself. He can cause earthquakes and ground tremors, and he gets an exoskeletal armor as part of this deal, along with a big kind of plasma flail, almost like a whip, which he uses as a primary weapon. It can be turned into a whip, it can be curled up into a shield. It's a very versatile and very groovy weapon. We have Anton Pamplushtis as Ursus. Now, Ursus is a kind of werebear berserker. He turns into a humanoid with a bear head and bear claws at times, and turns into a complete Soviet bear at other times. So basically, and he's very resistant to bullets when he's in his werebear configuration. And is pretty much super powered. Imagine a super powered Siberian bear, and that's Ursus in this one. We have Sanzar Madiev as Khan, who's from Kazakhstan. He's a master of blades. They call him the Wind Man. He's moved so fast it looks like he's teleporting at times. He has two enormous curved swords as part of his ensemble. He moves super fast, he's super strong, he's incredibly gymnastic, and can avoid even gunfire at short distances. And when he moves really fast, there's a black gaseous kind of trail, a little bit like Nightcrawler in the X-Men series, a little bit like that kind of Banff kind of thing, except he's moving really fast, he's not actually teleporting. And then we have Xenia, played by Alina Lanina, who's a water woman. She's superhuman, flexible and agile, acrobat, gymnast, martial artist, and she can also become invisible and control water. So very, very useful abilities to have. Now, running the Guardians team, we don't have Nick Fury or somebody like that. We have Major Elena Larina, played by Valeria Skrirando, who's a beautiful blonde woman in a military uniform who runs the organization on behalf of the Russian government. Now, the antagonist of the piece is a character called August Kuratov, played by Stanislav Shurin. And he's kind of a cyborg with a machine called Module 1, which allows him to control any technological equipment by generating an electric-like energy. And again, I'm paraphrasing a little bit from Wikipedia. He decides to build his own army, and he also takes over a bunch of spider robot tanks that the Russian army is testing, which are very cool. The spider tanks are among the best bits of this movie because they can tumble around like bugs. They've got machine guns mounted on the top of them and rocket launchers and surface-to-air missiles and all sorts of other stuff. So the team is found and brought together by Major Larina because of the threat of Kuratov, who has decided he's going to take over the world by taking control of a Star Wars era American satellite nobody knows about, which has an enormous rail gun, well, not a rail gun, an enormous plasma gun as part of its work. Now, to control this, through control the satellite and through every other satellite in the world, he needs an enormous antenna. What he does is he takes over central Moscow and moves one of the major towers in the city adjacent to another tower and hangs it up by enormous cables and beams of metal to make an extended tower. And the Guardians have to go and attack him. The first attempt to attack the Kuratov, the bad guy, doesn't work, and they get their asses handed to them. And so as they're kind of licking their wounds and replanning and getting the suits together, there's a great training montage of them with the suits in this one as well. So you need a good training montage with superhero movies, and Guardians doesn't fail in that. There's a great training montage with the second time around. They've got to go to this tower that the bad guy has created and basically go and defeat him. And they end up doing it kind of indirectly, but in an interesting way. Now, the characters themselves, the individuals themselves, they don't age. The heroes are immortal. So all of them are people who have seen their loved ones die, because they're from the start of the Cold War. They're each of them the best part of a century old. Xenia is amnesiac. Leia ends up at a monastery. He decides to become a monk at a monastery in Armenia and lives there. Ursus lives out in the forests and lives a hermit's life. And Khan is in southern Kazakhstan, almost working as a kind of hitman for hire. There's a nice scene of him attacking a convoy of SUVs, which is in the trailer, and it is very cool as well. So all of them are kind of damaged human beings. Ursus is scared that he may get stuck in a bear form, which is a possibility. And so every time he uses his powers, he's rolling the dice a bit. And Leia, because he's seen all of his family die, has kind of withdrawn from the world. And like all good superhero movies, this one does have that aspect of the superpowered humans forming a kind of family. And in fact, at one stage, in order to defeat the bad guy, they form a gestalt almost, and their powers to defeat Kuratov are joined together in a way that enables them to defeat him. And that's kind of cool too. Now, again, this is from another culture. This is from another view of history as well, because there's a certain nostalgia for the old Soviet Union that runs through Guardians. And while there's a nostalgia for it also, there's an acknowledgement of the abuses that science was put to and that the government performed on its citizens in making these superhuman people. And all of the there are some blueprints and notes on their creation that come over the front titles of the movie, showing us what's happened to them and who they are. I don't read Russian, so the text of the titles doesn't do a lot for me, but there are also some graphics and illustrations very much of the period, so the period touch is nice, that show how these people became who they are. There are x-rays of Ursus and all sorts of things like that, which are kind of cool and do give us a sense that this is a very lived-in world. And that's that again, they've taken a lot of care with this. The movie, as I said, it's supposed to have been a box office failure, but I think as time's moved on and as other non-Russian-speaking countries have found out about it, there may be an extended lifespan to this. The copy I've got of this had fan-made subtitles on it, because it hasn't quite been released in a lot of Western markets yet. But nonetheless, I think when it comes out, and if hopefully it'll come out in Australia in some kind of permanent form, I'll be buying a copy of the DVD or Blu-ray. There's no question of it, because as I said to somebody, my friend Grant Watson, who's been on the podcast before, I said to Grant, Yeah, I will buy a copy of it because I want a lot more Russian Fantastica in my movie library. I want not just English language science fiction films. I mean, I'm collecting a few French movies, for instance, a couple of Italian ones. There really are some really strange Italian science fiction movies from the 1960s in particular, which are worth getting. And if there are any other countries you think I should do, Korean, of course, I'm trying to do, and Japan being the obvious ones. But if you think there's anything I should kind of take a look at that I haven't or haven't mentioned, definitely send some feedback to feedbackpaleo@gmail.com because I like being made aware of things that I'm not aware of in genres, particularly when it comes to foreign language films. And the other thing there too is you can't see everything, you can't know everything. I pick up on things and I hear little hints of things and I find things like Guardians and Attraction, but nobody can hold it all in their brain. It's all out there somewhere. But we need our friends and colleagues and people of a like mind to help us find them, which is partly why I'm doing the podcast, of course. But if you've got any suggestions on particularly recent genre films from other cultures that I should see, please tell me because I want to include them in future podcasts as well. But to get back to Guardians, I think it works really well. The characters are well drawn. The acting is good. Particularly Sebastian Sisak as Lair and Alina Lanina is quite good as well. They kind of do give us a feel that their characters are lived in, and that's important for this kind of stuff. It's one of the things that we've only kind of realised maybe since Eric Banner's Hulk in, was it 2004, that getting good actors into films based on superhero stories is the way to go. You don't just get somebody you can afford. You stretch yourself and find people who are going to be ripe for it. And, of course, that continued on, particularly starting with Robert Downey Jr. playing Iron Man and Tony Stark, getting quality actors in there and just letting them do what they do best rather than letting them become a cliche and just cash a check is something that's help to make the superhero genre what it is now. And Guardians does take that on. The acting is strong. Now, the villain of the piece is probably the weakest part of it, to be really honest with you. And I don't think it's the fault of the actor. Stanislav Shuren as Kuratov has a lot of makeup to work under. He's got a big, bulky muscle suit. He's probably muscly himself, I'm not sure. Let me just look for you. I'm going to look at IMDb so I can find out about this guy. Stanislav Shuren's got 2 acting credits on IMDb, which is not to say that he's a bad actor. And he's not bulked up. He's a kind of average-sized guy. So putting him into the muscle suits and letting him act through a whole bunch of cables sticking out of his head and out of his arms and things, particularly if he is an actor who isn't used to that kind of acting, you've got acting through makeup's a particular skill. And it's one that a lot of people have a learning curve with. He tries to emote through all of this muck that he's got all over his body and his face. But I think that the difficulties weren't overcome, let's say. And that's a little bit of a shame. If there is a Guardians 2, I think that the strength will be who they get and how they portray the villain. Because you need that balance there. It's really cool that they've got a guy who's a telekinetic rock man, having a were-bear in there, having an invisible woman and a blade master, and all of that stuff is cool, and all of that stuff really does work. But you've got to have a balance that's more than the special effects. You've got to have the villain be the balance rather than the special effects. And the special effects here, of course, are superb as well. They really do work. And in particular, they work with the characters. There are some bits with the plasma flail that Lair has that are really cool. That's a weapon equal to Captain America's shield or Thor's hammer. It has aspects of both to it, and it really works. And also, having Ursus with a giant machine gun is very cool. And the machine gun is kind of has an AI attached to it. So when he's in full bear mode, it's mounted on his back as he runs and it targets the enemy itself. But when he's in kind of werebear form, he uses the machine gun. It's a very kind of computer gamey look, but there's a great moment where he throws a character up in the air and then machine guns him, which I kind of like. That stuff always gets me. It's a movie that's a lot of fun to watch. And even though it's not perfect and Russia is still on a learning curve when it comes to superhero movies, it really is worth supporting. I mean, sometimes you get movies that aren't perfect and have flaws in them, but because of what they're trying to do and because of where you know they're going to be going in the future, there's a great fondness you can have for it and a great support that you want to give to it. You know, there's goodwill towards this movie is probably what I'm trying to say. Now, I was trying to look up Russian superhero comics, and there aren't that many. There are a whole bunch of them that DC and Marvel had, heroes and villains, for instance. But there was a comic book publisher called Bubble Comics, which I don't know whether it's still working in Russia, but they had characters like Danila the Demon Slayer, a grim avenger who exterminates demons with the power of living tattoos made from Satan's blood, Major Grom, a detective in St. Petersburg, Friar, a cross inlay who has a cross inlay with power gems, Red Fury, who's the best thief in the world, a space smuggler called Meteora, and Lilia Romanova, an ordinary Russian teenager who unveils the secret of mysterious book wizard order, whose members have been trying to hold the balance between book worlds and our reality. Marvel's got a whole shit ton of Russian characters, of course, the most obvious one being Black Widow. And I've been trying to find some more, and there's not a hell of a lot of them. I mean, there are a few Russian movies. I've mentioned Black Lightning previously, I did a podcast about that, but there aren't really a lot of them. They go down to mention people like Molotov Cocktease, who is one of the kind of half-villains in the Venture Brothers, but it's a shame that Russia doesn't have a history of comic books, because they would then have an immensely rich load of source material, the same way that Marvel and DC and other comic book companies have in the English-speaking world. But it's a little bit of a shame, but they're taking baby steps, and Guardian is a good baby step on this. Guardians is a good baby step on this direction, and I enjoyed it. If there's a second one, I'm there. The first one, I'm definitely buying genuine copies of. You can find it illicitly at the moment if you'd like to. But if you do like it, I would strongly encourage anyone to actually fork out the money when the time comes and get yourself a decent copy of it. I'll be getting a copy whether I have to get it overseas or not. I may end up getting it through eBay. But I will definitely be getting a copy of Guardians for my permanent collection. So that's about it this time around. It is time again to knock, knock, knock that naughty clock that says it's time to go. So thank you for listening. As I said, next time around, we're going to be doing it live from Continuum 13. And if you're in or around Melbourne, you might want to consider getting a membership for Continuum. They've got like $10 membership for Friday night, so you can taste it and see whether you like it. It's the National Science Fiction Convention this year as well, which always makes it a much bigger circus than it would otherwise be. And there are a lot of people that do a lot of good volunteer work and who deserve our support. I'm going to be doing three panels. I'm going to be doing the one with Martian Driving. I'm doing one about the Marvel Netflix universe with a bunch of good people. And I'm also doing one about the TV series The Expanse, which I've mentioned on a previous Martian Driving podcast. Looking forward to all of them. They're going to be a groovy thing for me to enjoy, and hopefully for the audiences to enjoy. There's a special energy you get from doing a live talk about something that you don't get otherwise, and the performance aspect of it is something I enjoy. So anyway, take care of yourselves. I will be back in a short time, later this week in fact, with another Paleo Cinema podcast. I'll be back in 2 weeks with Martian Drive-In podcast. I hope to stop having these little hiatuses in between. I've got a few health issues at the moment, not physical health issues, but just getting my ducks lined up that require me to kind of take some space at times, and I apologize for the delays that that may cause. But anyway, again, thank you to the Patreon subscribers. Everyone should be a Patreon subscriber. Chris Mounts, who gives a podcast a lot of credit on social media is a Patreon subscriber, and he won some movie posters off me on the annual giveaway for being a Patreon subscriber, as did Tansy Raina Roberts, who was on the last Paleo Cinema podcast. She got a bunch of stuff that I'm about to send her for being a Patreon subscriber. So anyway, there are lots of advantages to it as well. You help the podcast out, and you've got a chance of getting some cool shit every April. So anyway, thank you again to the Patreon subscribers, including the two Kerrys. Thank you to everybody else for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. Check these movies out. Stretch yourself. Go outside your comfort zone. Go outside your language comfort zone. And try to find some Russian Fantastica, Planeta Burr, anything you can find. Just go for it. There's a lot of fun there. Anyway, I'll be back soon. Take care of yourselves and take care of each other. Keep watching the skies, and I'll be back soon. Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers, and here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, our caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, our script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve, our script doctor, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Carrie, our second script doctor, Richard, our set photographer, and our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.